Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Monday, the 29th of July, these are our main stories. At least 65 Nigerians have been killed in clashes that followed a funeral in Borno State. The US Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, is resigning following a number of disagreements with President Trump. The personal doctor of the Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, believes he's been affected by an unknown chemical. In Afghanistan, the president's running mate in upcoming elections has been wounded in a militant attack. Also in this podcast, Iran pledges to allow women to attend football matches. And later,
heavy metal knitting is basically what it says on the tin, a mixture of heavy metal and knitting. Let go, let loose, just go for it, knit.
The first ever heavy metal knitting world championships. But first, at least 65 people have lost their lives after suspected Boko Haram militants opened fire on a funeral in Nigeria's northeastern state of Borno. The attack took place outside the Borno state capital, Maiduguri, and is thought to have been in retaliation for the killing of 11 Boko Haram fighters 2 weeks ago. A local government official, Mohamed Bulama, said most people were killed as they pursued the militants after the initial attack.
During the burial, they attacked them at the graveyard. Immediately they killed 21. Later, when the remaining people heard about it, then they went after them. They still killed them. That way it makes the total up to 65.
Our reporter Chris Iwoka is following the story from Abuja.
According to local vigilantes, gunmen riding on motorbikes descended on a particular village and opened fire on a group of mourners who were gathered preparing to bury their dead, a dead relative, and shot sporadically at them. Many people were killed in the process, and the attackers proceeded from that village to a nearby village about 9 kilometers from the first one and also attacked the village where some people were also killed. This is a recent attack and it's coming at a time that the Nigerian government has claimed that it's defeated Boko Haram. But in recent weeks, Boko Haram attacks alongside a splinter group, the IS-linked ISWAP, have been very active within the northeast of the country. On Thursday last week, there was an attack on IDP camps. And then before that, we have also heard of attack targeting military bases with some very fatal casualties.
An attack on a funeral, this is going to cause particular revulsion.
Yes, a lot of people are very, very unhappy, especially with the way the security situation is being handled in the northeast. When the group of, armed men descend on a village who are just carrying on with their own local normal life and then start shooting at them, especially at a time that they are, gathered in a solemn moment to bury a dead relative, it becomes something that is quite repulsive. And a lot of people are asking questions, why is this kind of attack still going on at this time?
Chris Iwoka in Abuja. To the US now, where it's been announced that the Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, is resigning. The news was confirmed by President Trump in his usual manner through a tweet. Our correspondent in the United States is Peter Bowes.
This hasn't really come as a surprise, and people have been speculating about this for some time. We know that for several months now, Mr. Coats has been at odds with the president over key areas of national intelligence and international policy, especially applying to North Korea and to Russia, and in particular on Russia, after that 2018 meeting in Finland between President Putin and Mr. Trump. It was following that meeting that Mr. Trump challenged the US intelligence community's conclusions about Moscow interfering in the 2016 presidential race. And Mr. Coates at the time made it very clear that he was at odds with what the president was saying and also questioned whether there should be a future meeting between these two leaders at the White House.
Because this is a really important position, isn't it? You're in charge of 17 US spy agencies. You report directly to President Trump.
Yes, it's quite a unique position in that respect, the direct reporting to the president, as apart from other departmental heads. So this is a very close, potentially a very close relationship with the president. And as you suggest, a very wide brief, international policy, especially applying to security matters. And during these quite heady times in recent months, and I mentioned Russia, of course, negotiations with North Korea as well, that seem to have stalled to some extent. This is a key role in terms of advising the president what the American security agencies are saying. And as we now know, Mr. Trump is wants sometimes to argue with that and to take a different opinion.
President Trump has already named Dan Coates' successor. He's a man called John Ratcliffe. What do we know about him?
He is a former US attorney. He's a Republican congressman. He, in recent days, actually has made headlines because he was one of those congressmen challenging and quite fiercely questioning Robert Mueller during that committee hearing last week about the Russia investigation. And it was quite an aggressive line of questioning, which reportedly, according to US media, impressed Mr. Trump. And his name has occasionally been floated for top jobs in the Trump administration, Attorney General for one, but there isn't a vacancy there right now. And Mr. Trump, clearly from that tweet that you reference, sees him as someone that he can get on with, that seems to be quite close in terms of policy matters. And he, just to quote what the president said, he said, "John will lead and inspire greatness for the country he loves."
Peter Bowes in the US. Brazilian police have been sent to a remote Amazon region to investigate reports that an indigenous leader has been killed by gold miners. A reporter in Rio de Janeiro, Julia Carneiro, told me more about the circumstances of his death.
Well, this happened in the heart of the Amazon, in the Amapá state, in an indigenous reserve where illegal gold mining has been taking place for decades, as in other parts of the Amazon, but is really stepping up. And a few days ago, this indigenous leader, Emira Wayampi, 68 years old, on Wednesday, he was found dead. His body was found. And this happened in the midst of invasions happening in this indigenous reserve, Alex, with illegal gold miners taking over one village at least, and invading houses, intimidating residents, and leading indigenous people to flee to a neighboring village, and the police in Brazil and the Indigenous Foundation in Brazil to be summoned among fear of a bloodshed. The stage of things now is that police are at the site and investigations have started, but they've only just reached the site, and more details about how this happened and how this leader was killed are still due to come out, but it seems clear that he was killed violently. They say there were marks on his body, and it appears that he may have been stabbed to death.
We're getting reports that Brazil's president, Jair Bolsonaro, may go to the area tomorrow. Now, this is interesting because up to now, he's been a big supporter of the exploration of mineral reserves in the Amazon.
Yes, it's going to be really interesting to see how he will react, because for many environment organizations, some politicians here as well, they see his very strong defense of exploiting mineral resources in the Amazon as a trigger to, there was fear that this could lead to violence, and this is really being seen as a major incident that hadn't happened in decades, and seems to be a signal of groups feeling empowered to act like this. So just last week, he was openly defending gold mining to be legalized. Gold mining is very damaging to the environment. It uses mercury, and that's why this is such a sensitive topic for the environment and for indigenous peoples.
Julia Carneiro reporting. The personal doctor of the Russian opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, has said she believes he's been affected by an unknown chemical. Mr. Navalny was transferred from prison to hospital for treatment for what was described as an acute allergic reaction. Gleb Borshevsky is in Moscow.
Mr. Navalny's spokeswoman, Kira Yarmish, said on Twitter that the opposition leader, who has been jailed numerous times for public order offences, was suffering from a swollen face and a skin rash. She added that he had never previously suffered from such a condition. Mr. Navalny's sudden illness and its timing has caused concern in some quarters, not least because a number of prominent Kremlin critics, including Alexander Litvinenko, have in the past been the victims of poisoning.
Gleb Borshevsky. The political crisis in Hong Kong is now in its eighth week and the levels of violence are escalating. Tense standoffs between riot police and pro-democracy protesters have now ended after another day of clashes on Sunday. Thousands of young protesters defied a police ban to return to the streets, chanting anti-police slogans. Riot police fired tear gas and rubber bullets to stop activists reaching the Chinese government's official headquarters in Hong Kong. Our correspondent Stephen McDonnell was there and described the chaotic scenes.
The protesters would be throwing bricks, metal poles, other projectiles, the police responding with tear gas and rubber bullets. But now the protesters are coming so well equipped, the tear gas isn't working really, because the protesters all have managed to get themselves gas masks, they've got helmets, homemade shields to repel the rubber bullets. And so it is becoming harder for the riot police to clear the streets. And so it's only when they move in with overwhelming force, with hundreds of police, with baton charges and the like, pushing protesters, for example, into a train station to get them to leave, that it seems to work. And right now, it is quiet here. All of the protesters have gone home. And in fact, soon after they've forced them home, the riot police have also gone home. I think both sides are pretty exhausted. We've had 2 days in a row of 8 hours worth of running street battles, but we're no closer to any resolution.
How much longer can this continue? I mean, who's going to win?
I cannot think of how it's going to finish. On the one hand, the police and the government might think if they just tough it out long enough, fatigue will stop the protests going on. But that's a long way from happening, and in some ways it's becoming more energised. I don't know what the government's going to do to rein this in. I mean, one step, I suppose, would be for the leader to resign. She's very unpopular. And this all goes back to the beginning of this, when hundreds of thousands of people were marching through the streets peacefully, saying they didn't want this extradition bill, allowing for people to be sent to mainland Chinese courts controlled by the Communist Party. That was just dismissed by the government here. Carrie Lam just said people don't understand what they're talking about. Critics would say that she showed an extreme level of arrogance in just ignoring those enormous protests. And this is what's driven the younger university age demonstrators, for example, to say that the peaceful way doesn't work, and that's why they're escalating. Now, I'm not sure where they think escalation is going to take them either, because the obvious end point, if it got too bad, would be for Beijing to take what might be the nuclear option and send out the People's Liberation Army to take back control of the streets by force. But if they did that, well, what's left of Hong Kong then? I mean, that's the end of Hong Kong as we know it.
Stephen McDonnell in Hong Kong. The Afghan president, Ashraf Ghani, launched his re-election campaign on Sunday, promising to start peace talks with the Taliban. But in a violent reminder, if it was needed, that the war is continuing, the president's running mate, Amrullah Saleh, has been injured in an attack on his office in a northern district of Kabul. 9 people were killed and 25 were wounded. Julian Marshall heard more from journalist Bilal Sawari in the Afghan capital.
The attack took place at a very busy intersection. This is Amrullah Saleh's political office. And Mr. Saleh was inside the building as it was being attacked by at least 4 attackers in a complex attack. And all of the attackers were killed by the Afghan special forces. Amrullah Saleh worked as the former intelligence chief, and now he's running on President Ghani's ticket as a VP. Has been a long time critic of the Taliban as well as Pakistan's military and intelligence services. So he's got a lot of enemies. But what is quite surprising about this attack, so far no one has claimed responsibility. for carrying out this attack. So we're waiting on that. But Mr. Amrullah Saleh managed to get out of what could have been a very deadly situation for him. We saw pictures of Mr. Saleh with stains of blood. We also saw a number of rival politicians going up to Mr. Saleh and checking on him.
We still don't know who carried out this attack, but whoever did was very conscious of the timing, namely on the day that the president launched his re-election campaign.
Absolutely. I think security, or should I say the lack of security, is a major concern, not just for politicians in elections, but for the people of Afghanistan. I think what you see over the last several months is these deadly waves of attacks, where you're talking about Taliban truck bombs and car bombs in cities like Kabul, or you're looking at airstrikes and night raids by the Afghan government. I think clearly what you're looking at is a major escalation in military operations. And I think it is quite also clear that this is also a war for leverage. Should there be any direct talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban, should there be some sort of a peace process which is meaningful?
Bilal Sawawi. Coming up later in this podcast, Colombia has a new sporting hero.
For us, it's a very emotional moment because it's the first time that a Colombian is winning the Tour de France.
His name is Egan Bernal. In 2014, the Yazidi minority in Iraq were killed in their thousands, and many more were abducted as sex slaves by so-called Islamic State. Nearly 400,000 are still living in displacement camps in northern Iraq. The Yazidis' last hereditary ruler, or prince, Tahsin Said Ali, died in January, and his son, Hazim Tahsin Bek, has now succeeded him. He was enthroned in a ceremony on Saturday in Lalish, the Yazidis' holiest site in Iraq's mountainous northwest region. Julian Marshall spoke to Baroness Emma Nicholson, who's a member of the British House of Lords. She's taken up the cause of the persecuted Yazidis.
They have an interesting setup, which is a small spiritual council headed by the reigning prince. And that's the key role for Prince Hazim. He has to keep all the people together. The spiritual council is a little bit like a unicameral parliament. It has something of everyone on it, of all of their particular setup. And that is the ruling body, and it's headed by the prince. And he's always having to gather opinions of his people in order to persuade the spiritual council to make a move forward, for example. They have a temple at Lalish that I visited a number of times. It is a very, very, very simple place indeed, where they worship the one God. It's an extremely ancient faith. I would suggest that it probably predates Zoroastrianism, and it's a faith that is common almost in the region, almost Sufism, in thanking God all the time for the light, for being alive, for family, for friendships, and for the harvest. They're a very agricultural-based community.
So Hazim Tahsin Bek is a spiritual or political leader of the Yazidis?
There is no division in that sense. Therefore, he is leader of everything. He is, as it were, both the queen and, if you like it, the prime minister. They have a unicameral system, which is the House of Lords and the House of Commons together, as it were. So they have something of everyone on it, plus the bishop's bench, if you like it. They have the ordinary people, they have the peers, who they actually call peers, and they have the royal family, and they have the priests. And each section of their system doesn't marry into the other. So the priests marry the other priests' families, as it were. They are all priests. The peers marry into peers' families. They are the highly educated elite. They provide, for example, magnificent medical professionals, some of whom are here. And then we have the ordinary people, who they call the common people, the madan, and they are murads. they are everyone else. That is all represented on the spiritual council. And the prince, who is effectively elected, he is in fact meant to moderate, meant to lead, and meant to help them all take the most important decisions. They're surprisingly democratic to me, in that women have equal rights, women in a less modern terminology, of course, but women are in on everything, and women are able to do everything, perform everything, be everything, except be priests. But they're absolutely everywhere else at every single level, and very, very well educated too. They never carry weapons. They're not aggressive. These are farming people originally, who are also extremely hardworking.
Baroness Emma Nicholson. Iran has promised that women will be allowed into Iranian football stadiums from this October to attend 2022 World Cup qualifiers. It's come after the FIFA president, Gianni Infantino, wrote to the Iranian Football Federation in June. I got more on the problem from Hadi Nili from BBC Persian.
There's been a number of occasions that Iranian fans, which happen to be females, showed up at the stadiums and they were not allowed into the stadiums, even though Iranian officials have been saying that we are going to allow women into the stadiums, we are going to sell tickets to them, we are going to let women in the stadiums, but mostly police was not cooperating, they say, the officials say. But practically what the activists in Iran say is that there has never been really commitment by the authorities to allow women into the stadiums.
So why are women banned?
Those authorities who are actively pro these restrictions are saying that the stadiums are not the best place, the best atmosphere for women. But the women activists say that we have to choose for ourselves. Authorities also mentioned that there are not enough infrastructure for that. They say that we don't have enough service rooms for women to be added to the stadiums, not enough entrances which should be separated from men. Now they are saying that if we are going to allow women into the stadiums, we need to make it separated, separate room for them, separate service rooms for them, separate entrances, separate hallways for them.
So now the Iranian Football Federation has made this pledge to allow women into stadiums. How real is the commitment they're making?
There has been other pledges like this in the past, but this is the most clear one from the highest official in Iranian government. We can see that so many Iran sports officials are worried that with this new code of discipline by FIFA, this updated code of discipline, they might actually face severe punishments if they don't allow women into the stadiums. So they are not allowing any people to the stadiums now. It's been a couple of weeks that they are not allowing anyone into the stadiums to avoid the repercussion by the FIFA. So they are not allowing even men, because if they allow men, that would be discrimination. They are not allowing anyone. So there won't be any discrimination for now until they decide about
it. That's not a situation that can continue, is it?
It's not going to continue for a long time, probably, because the teams are not happy, the football clubs are not happy with this situation. So most likely this pressure from FIFA is helping those within Iranian government who has been pushing for less restrictions for women, for allowing women into the stadiums.
Hadi Nili from BBC Persian. In Finland, they have been casting on and rocking out. Believe it or not, they've hosted the first ever heavy metal knitting world championships. Our reporter Claire McDonnell takes up the yarn.
Heavy metal knitting. Any idea? Well, it's a team event. The knitter or knitters knit on stage in front of and in time with a heavy metal band. Not convinced? Well, let's hear from a woman who is.
My name is Natalie Cortada, and I was the first ever person in the world to be on stage knitting to heavy metal. Heavy metal knitting is basically what it says on the tin, a mixture of heavy metal and knitting. Someone had the brilliant idea to combine the both and create this first heavy metal knitting world championship.
And that championship has just taken place in the town of Joensuu in Finland, with 12 finalists from Denmark, Finland, Japan, Latvia, Russia, Sweden, the US and the UK. You can wear anything, fancy dress preferred. You can perform anyhow you like. And as Natalie explains, you can knit with anything.
I knit with unusual materials to take it to a new dimension. Pretty much 90% use recycled materials. Inner tube yarn is actually quite thick. You can't make it too thin because it might break or stretch. But it makes it really quite tough to knit. It's also quite smelly.
Giga Body Metal from Japan took home the top prize. Less knitting, more sumo wrestling, it has to be said. But the jury rate the performances by attitude, performance skills, audience reaction and by their heavy knitting hood. Denmark's crafts came in second, with needles from the US placing third. And if you're still not convinced about this marriage between haberdashery and headbanging, well, the organised say metal music is all about the rhythm and so is knitting. And Natalie agrees.
A lot of people have told me, you know, what the hell are you doing? What? Knitting? Heavy metal? How does that link up? And in knitting or crochet or any kind of textile work, there's a kind of rhythm to it, which goes very well with metal. Just let go, let loose, just go for it, knit.
Claire McDonald with that report. This was to have been the day when a Frenchman won the Tour de France for the first time in more than 30 years. In fact, so confident was the French media that Julien Alaphilippe or Thibaut Pinot would be that man, they were calling this the Jour de France. But those dreams were dashed on Friday in the Alps, and instead, Colombian Egan Bernal has crossed the line in the Champs-Élysées in Paris to become this year's champion. He's the first South American to win the Tour, and at 22, the third youngest. Large numbers of his fellow Colombians had gathered along the Champs-Élysées to welcome him home.
Well, for us, it's a very emotional moment because it's the first time that a Colombian is winning the Tour de France. So then it's important also for us to be with him and to support him in this important day.
We're here supporting Egan Bernal, so we're very proud. First time a Colombian winning Tour de France. We're very happy, very excited. We feel that we're in Colombia even though we're in Paris, so it's very happy, we're very excited.
Julian Marshall caught up with the Financial Times journalist Gideon Long in Zipaquirá, where Egan Bernal grew up.
Well, I'm in the main square in Zipaquirá, in Bernal's hometown. There's a big TV screen has been set up in front of the local municipal building, and about 5,000 people gathered in front of that TV screen, and there were other squares around the town as well where TV screens are set up. In total, probably around 10,000 people have been watching this final stage of the Tour de France, and a huge cheer went up, as I'm sure you can imagine, when he finally crossed the finish line. Many people have turned out in their yellow Colombian football shirts and they're waving the red, blue and yellow Colombian flag. A very festive atmosphere, as you can imagine.
Egan Bernal grew up there, but did he cycle there as well?
He did. He grew up here and cycled around the hills around Zipaquirá. This is a mountainous area, a mountainous part of Colombia, just around 50 kilometers from the capital, Bogota. He was initially a mountain biker, that was his speciality, and he actually only switched to road racing around 5 or 6 years ago. So something of an unknown quantity, and a very young man. He's not only the first Colombian to win the Tour de France, he's the first Latin American to win the Tour de France, and the youngest man to win the Tour de France in over a century. So yes, he grew up here mountain biking, switched to road racing, and it was really when he joined Team Sky, now Team Ineos, that he broke through, and this has been his stellar year, winning first the Tour of Switzerland and now the greatest prize of all in world cycling, the Tour de France.
And is cycling something that people in Zipaquirá do a lot of?
They do. Cycling is a big sport in Colombia generally. I would say of all the Latin American countries, this is the country in which cycling has the biggest following. If you go out into the hills around Bogota on any weekend, you'll see groups of men and women in Lycra cycling through the hills. And lots of cycle clubs have come out today into the square to watch this final stage of the Tour of the France. So it is a big sport, and I'm sure that this will give it a big boost.
Gideon Long. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.